It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
To the ESPN Footy Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the ESPN Footy Podcast for another week. I'm Jared Barker, Jake Michaels, and Champion Data's Christian Jolly with me to unwrap a big weekend of footy. Plenty of exciting stuff to get to today, gents, and some interesting numbers we're going to get our head around, Jake. But first, something you notice from the weekend of footy.
Well, we've said it a few times, but Isaac Heaney, I don't think people, we were just saying before we started recording, I don't think people truly understand how good this guy's playing in a historical context. It's one of the best starts to the season. It kind of goes beyond a start now. We've played a third of the year and it is extraordinary what he's doing. And, you know, I was up in Sydney over the weekend and got to watch him for the first time this year up close. And once again, he was brilliant. And again, getting in the Brownlow votes, in my opinion. So it made me think he's polled in my mind in every game so far this year, in every game he's played. I've got him on 16.5 votes, but I think he could easily be 17 or 18 even, depending on how the umpires see, obviously. And I thought, let's look back on the previous winners over the last few seasons and see where they were at, how many votes they had to their name after 8 games. So just looking at the total over a few. So Dangerfield 14, Martin 8, Mitchell 11, Fife 14, Neil 15, Wines 11, Cripps 16, Neil 12. So to put it in that perspective, like they were the winners that year.
He's on track to have a 30 plus year.
I think ahead of all of them right now. And he doesn't look like slowing down. It's an extraordinary start to the year.
Interesting. Christian?
I think we spoke about this one on the podcast before, but the Goal of the Week nominations came out, I think, yesterday, and I was surprised that the one that I probably would have put on there was the Nick Dacos match winner, which I think
you
we spoke about.
That on there.
I would have, just again, I think the way it was kicked and the time of the game all sort of equates to it. I know, going back to a point where we had a discussion last year on the Dan Houston shot after siren, I wasn't big
so
on that getting into the Goal
here?
Of the Week.
What were the three nominations I did think, this week?
Isaac Rankin was one of them.
Maybe the Fritsch goal.
And Stengel goal. Against Melbourne from the pocket. But I looked at Nick Dacos. I thought it was a pretty difficult shot. And obviously a big moment of the game.
His winning goal.
Yep. Went into the expected scores, and this surprised me even more. Went into the expected scores to see who had kicked the hardest goal of the round. Nick Dacos and Bobby Hill both kicked goals from almost identical pocket where Nick Dacos did kick the winner at the end. Bobby Hill kicked one 40 seconds into the fourth quarter. They both had expected scores of about 1.4 and an expected accuracy of just below 20%. So they were the two hardest goals kicked for the round. So I'm all for Nick Dacos should be up there for goal.
I can't believe that.
Me neither. I looked at it. It doesn't take into account.
When you do think about it, he's pocket, facing the boundary. Snap from the pocket. Yeah.
That is not the pocket.
That's the forward pocket.
When Nick Dacos kicked that goal, is not the pocket.
How often do you watch footy?
You're calling it the pocket? How far in? So you're saying anything that's not directly in a straight line from the goal square.
Where are you saying the pocket is?
How?
He was in the forward pocket.
He's not on the boundary.
Yeah, that's the boundary
that
line.
That doesn't mean that's
on the forward pocket. So we have, it's not directly in front
we have
of
three,
pocket.
We have three zones, and we have boundary, pocket, and corridor. He'd be,
so how big he'd is the pocket?
Be in the
anything
up,
how big?
Head,
okay, well, the question is how big is the boundary? Just anything that's on the boundary line?
Yeah, probably about two or 3 metres.
I think there's a big variance in what a shot from the pocket can be.
So what would it be? Obviously, we know how expected scores is measured now, but that being the hardest goal to have kicked on the weekend,
yep.
What's that?
It came down to just where he was, it's all within a range of distance, so 30 to 40 metres out. He was on, it was a right footer kicking from that side and he snapped it, so his foot was sort of on the far side of the goal. So it takes into account the right footer, whether it was an open side or closed side for him. He was being chased, so chasing pressure. They both him and Bobby Hill were under the same amount of pressure. I was just surprised that Nick Dacos was clearly recorded as a snap and had an expected accuracy exactly the same as Bobby Hill from a very similar spot who did a drop punt. So it's sort of showing us that from 2010 to 2024, whether you snap or do a drop punt on the run from that pocket hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Your likelihood of scoring, the whole competition basically kicks the same. But I would have thought Bailey Fritch's was the hardest goal, so I was surprised. That came up about the eighth hardest. He was being corralled, so he was under less pressure.
Eighth hardest.
Yeah, under less pressure and closer to the goals. So yeah, it was still. I mean, he still kicked a hard goal, but yeah, as I said, Nick Dacos being sort of, I think, snubbed for goal of the week nominee. At least it was a hard goal. The expected scores come up with that, and it was probably the most memorable goal of the weekend.
Well, it was. For
the numbers
sad
don't
reasons.
Lie, Jake, do they?
But the craziest part of that is it doesn't take into account the circumstance of the game. So I can understand it. Okay, yeah, it's the go-ahead match-winning goal essentially, but it doesn't factor any of that in, which makes it even more remarkable. That's why I was sort of saying, the Dan Houston goal going back to last year, or Jordan Dawson's goal in the showdown after Siren, those goals, I understand we don't necessarily give set shot goals goal of the year, but when they are match winning goals, difficult shots, I think you have to give them more, you give them more credit because of the circumstance of the game.
Yeah.
For sure. And just like you would give more credit to being behind and taking the shot as opposed to scores tied and taking the shot. I think it's harder to. There's more pressure.
Yeah, when you have to kick
it. When you have to kick it rather than just score,
The top eight all verse each other this week, and that's the sixth time since the final eight system has been introduced. But I was looking at the ladder a bit more deeply, and only four teams currently have a percentage under 95. Only four teams underneath 95%. So, Christian, when was the last time this was the case, and is it unusual to see it at this stage of the season? I think it just represents sort of how close the competition has been, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's looking at the bottom part of the ladder and how those are sort of rating to the rest of the season. So I think we've banged on about North Melbourne enough to sort of see where they're a
That's
fair
where
way
everyone's
for,
getting
for
their
the rest of the competition. Well, maybe it is that, but again, so 2023, six teams at this stage of the year were below 95%, seven in each of 22, 21, 5, 6, 7, 8. So usually we have a lot, between 5 to 8 teams that are below 95% at this time. You've got to go back to 2014 was the last time that only four teams were below 95% this late in the season.
Yeah.
But at the top of the ladder, it's also looking interesting in terms of percentage. So Essendon currently fifth on the ladder at 95.22%. It's the second lowest for a team to be fifth or higher on the ladder this late in the season. So yes, the bottom of the ladder is closer to the rest of the ladder than most years, but also we're seeing that currently what is the fifth best team, and we've spoken about Essendon in this terms previously, they're actually losing the season at the moment. They're sitting fifth on the ladder, but obviously scored fewer points than they've given away this year. So still a fair bit to sort out with the ladder, but I think we know from third to 16th, you are 50-50 games nearly every week that they're playing those two teams.
Good thing with Essendon's percentage is that can't remember if you don't like it when people say this, but I don't think their percentage matters now because they've had that draw. So it's probably less concerning for all the Bombers to be that team.
A little bit, but what happens if they have another draw?
Well, then it matters.
Of course.
So. But right now it doesn't. No, interesting stuff. Just quickly, Scott Pendlebury, he reached 10,000 disposals a couple of weeks ago. And we mentioned, I believe in last week's episode, that he hadn't yet reached 10,000 possessions. We went through the difference between disposals and possessions.
And believe it or not, I still heard about three or four commentators.
Only three or four.
Well, yeah. He had another game against the Blues on the weekend. Has he reached 10,000 possessions? If not, how far away is he?
He's very, very close. So at three off at the moment. So 9,997 possessions of the ball.
Do you reckon he'll get a big cheer when he gets to the 10,000 possessions?
Oh, let's hope so. So I also, I'll probably want to run a sort of an office sort of betting. What will his 10,000th possession be? So I've got a breakdown of all the sort of ways he's won the ball. So just start from uncontested contest possessions. 5,931 have been uncontested. 4,066 has been contested. But breaking it down, he's taken 1,548 marks, 4,064 handball receives, 473 free kicks.
It's a lot of free kicks.
Yeah, 2,746 ground balls.
And the footy pedals.
Yeah. 397 gathers, which is basically, it's probably one of the lesser known stat. A gather is, so a ball's kicked to you and it bounces rather than you taking a mark. So you still get you're basically getting an uncontested possession.
So how does that differ from a ground ball get?
Ground ball get is a contested possession where either team could have won it, so it's come off a spoil and it's not passed to anyone, whereas a gather is Oh, yeah,
the ground ball get is always going to be a contested possession.
Yeah.
Even if you gather it on the ground. That's a gather.
That'll be called a gather. So exactly. They all appear in their own categories. We don't double up on the categories. So 115 knock-ons. So when you knock it, don't take possession. Don't grab the ball, but knock it on. We give that a possession because it's as good as sort of, you know, taking it and passing it on. 653 gathers from hit-outs. So again, we talk about gathers around the field. They're from knock-ons and kicks, but you can also have gathers from hit-outs. And one ruck hard, which is basically going up in the ruck and grabbing it out of the ruck. So the Tom Hawkins, what he's been doing for 10 years. Tristan Cherry, who we spoke about, he's one of the leaders of it. So he's had one. So I would... haven't looked at it. Oh, it was 2014, so it was either third man up and he's come over the top and taken it out, which you could do back in those days, or he was the only ruckman, or he came up against another rover. But don't know. Will it be a mark? Will it be a handball receive? Will it be a free kick?
He only needs three. He'll be starting in the middle. I reckon it's a ground ball get for sure.
Oh, it's got to be handball receive going by the numbers here, doesn't it?
Hey, as long as it's not a free kick, I'm happy.
So a knock-on's a possession. Are hit-outs possessions as well? Because Todd Goldstein's coming up to 10,000.
Not a possession, but yeah, it's sort of their score launches and score involvements. They can give you as much value as a possession, but they don't count in your possession.
Would he have touched the footy, Goldstein, more than anyone else in the history of the game, given that you've got 10,000 hit-outs, but he also has his own disposals as well that you add to it? Pendlebury's had 10,000 disposals, so would Goldstein have touched the footy more than anyone else in the history of the game?
As in most touches of, a, just of touching the ball, the sheriff, or yeah. Like physically. Time, elapsed
just,
time
just
with
generally
the ball
touching
you.
Now that you think about
it. He'd have to be up there. I've never thought about it.
I don't know
before.
How many disposals he's had, but you add that to the 10,000 hit-outs.
Is that what you were thinking about lying in bed last night?
I honestly wasn't. There you go.
Yeah, that's not bad.
We'll move on. We said off the top that the top eight are playing each other this week. It's actually the top four versus the bottom four that are in that top eight this week. So it's a mouth-watering weekend of footy. But what is realistic, Christian, from this point of the season? Is the top eight set by this stage of the season usually, and how many changes are we likely to see from this point?
So you go back to 2000 and average it out. It's 1.4 changes per year from round eight onwards to what the final top eight will look like. So each of the past 3 years, so 2023, 22 and 21, we've seen two changes happen after round eight. 2020 with the shortened season, we only saw the one change, but 2019, 18, 17, 2, 2 and 2. So almost two consistently across the 6 or 7 years. 2016 was the last time we had zero changes to the top eight. Again, a lot of number twos and ones between then, and 2006, where we also had zero changes. So forecasting to a couple of years, 2026, I can tell you there'll be zero changes to the top eight after round eight going by these numbers. But yeah, every year, as I said, 1.4 changes. If you go from 2012 onwards, it's more closer to the two mark. So it was early 2000, we were seeing less changes. But I sort of had a look at, If you do have a change from round eight to the end of the season, who is actually missing out? So where were they on the ladder at round eight when they ended up missing finals?
Yeah.
The top two at round eight have never missed the finals in that time. So of the 37 teams.
Right. So Geelong, Sydney, they're safe.
Yep. They're there. Yep, based on that. Third place.
It shouldn't be overly surprising that
some of these numbers aren't overly surprising. They're pretty stock standard in terms of they go with the rankings. Five of them have been third. Four from fourth, four from fifth, five from sixth, nine miss from seventh, and 10 miss from eighth. So again, looking at the teams that are sitting seventh and eighth are probably the two most at risk of dropping out going by recent history.
Is that Freo and Carlton?
Or
Port Adelaide? I've got the ladder in front of me. But
Freo sixth, it's Port Carlton. Seventh, Carlton.
Yeah,
eight.
Carlton eighth, so Port Adelaide, Carlton.
Yeah. Look, I think it's very easy to get to a point in the year and say, do it every year and say, oh, these are the teams that are good now, these are teams that aren't good, and this is how it's going to stay. But the numbers clearly say that we do see, obviously not a lot of changes, but we do see changes, one or two a year. I think there's a change. I think there's an obvious change. Collingwood's ninth. Collingwood's going to be in there. I think that's as clear as day. They are one of the most informed teams in this comp. They've got over that slump to start the year, and they're as dangerous as anybody. So they're going to get in, whether they get up to the top four or not, I'm unsure about that. But I think they get in at the expense of probably the Bombers, to be honest. I still am not a real believer in Essendon. I know they've played some good footy at times, but I think looking at all those teams in the eight at the moment, Carlton is eighth, and I think they're probably only going to rise. Port as well, the advantage of playing at home. I think they they obviously play well there, and that's a huge advantage. Freo is probably the other one that I think you could look at and say. I think Essendon and Freo are the two that I'm just unsure about how good they are and whether they can maintain over the course of the season.
Funny because we said the percentage probably doesn't matter for Essendon until they get another draw, if they do. But the percentage that they have is still a good guide on how they're playing. As Christian said,
they've
gotten more scored against them than they have scored. And that's what would be concerning for them. But with the top eight, the way that I look at it is it's not necessarily the best teams make finals. You just have to win enough games to be able to qualify. And sometimes the fixture does have a lot to play in that. So I'm not as certain as you are that it will be Collingwood.
You're saying if you've got an easier
I think
draw.
The Pies have a tougher fixture. We've actually spoken about what their run home is later in the year. I don't think it's going to be that easy for them to chalk up the 13 or maybe 14 wins that they'll want to get.
But the gap's gone. The gap is their, you know, that draw. The gap is a draw. And it's gone because it was...
That could be
it
what
was getting to the point
in.
Where they were... I think when they went into the game against Brisbane, so if they lose this, they can be 3 to 4 games outside the eight. This is like, they must win this game. That's gone now. Mm. So I can't see any way in which they don't make it in. And I think the question is who falls
and
out.
And that's why I think everyone's sort of talking about this weekend being all top eight teams get to play against each other. If I'm... Collingwood are in the best spot, but from 9th to 13th, you're licking your lips if you can get a win this week. I think 9th to 13th are all playing teams below them, or 9th to 12th are at least. I think 12th's playing 13th.
Yeah.
Because you know that 4th to 8th,
I think Collingwood
at least two of those
be,
are going to lose this week, or if not, they have a draw and they sort of you catch up to them halfway. But yeah, Collingwood are a good chance to almost get in within a week or two.
I think they could.
Well, they play 8 games against teams currently below them, the Pies, but they've also got games against the Dockers and the Bombers, who they're probably more 50-50 games. You'd probably tip the Pies in those games.
I think most people would tip Collingwood in both those games.
It gets them to a realistic, I think, 13.5, maybe 14 wins. So I still think they might just scrape in, but it's not going to be as easy. And the other one I want to keep an eye on is Adelaide. So they've got 7 matches against teams below them, which would take them, according to my tally, 10 wins. But showdowns are always 50-50, and there's another one to come.
Yep.
The Dogs are currently above them, so that doesn't count, but they might beat them as well. And the Bombers, again, we don't know really how good they actually are. You add those 3 wins, potentially, and then they're on 13 wins. So I think Adelaide might be able to get in.
Crows are a bit of an interesting team this year. I think similar to Collingwood in some ways, in the sense that they obviously started poorly. There was a lot of talk about what's going on in Adelaide. But the last month has been really good. I think you go back, they haven't really played a bad game though this year. So they lost 4 straight to start. I think they played a game against Freo where they were well beaten over there. But aside from that, they've been in every game.
Gold Coast was horrible conditions, but they were never in that game to the last 15 minutes. But yeah, I'm looking at Adelaide and looking at the back end of their fixture. So their final 4 games come against Geelong at GMHBA, the Bulldogs they'll have at home, Port Adelaide the showdown, and then Sydney away at the SCG. So very, very hard 4 weeks.
Tough,
they'll need to be in the eight.
You never know about the Sydney game. That could be one where they've locked up first and just resting some play. The idea is we don't want to see that anymore. But you never know. You never know. And I think the fact that they have been in most games this year, they obviously beat Carlton, beat Port in the showdown, crushed North, and just lost to Essendon over the last month.
They should be competitive in pretty much every game.
Yeah, I don't think... I think they're better right now going into this weekend than their latter position would suggest.
We'll talk about the Dogs a bit later. I don't want to discount them yet. As much as the loss in the weekend was a bad one, I still think there's talent there for them to...
There's talent, but we've been saying this for a number of years. And the talent, you know, they've lost, going to lose Tom Liberatore again this weekend, which is a shame. I mean, I think that's something that's not being spoken about enough. The ongoing concussions that he's suffered.
Just
Very worrying.
Bad luck too. I mean, he's got a boot in the face.
The way in which it happened.
Sort of
that's the thing. Yeah. You think Tom Liberatore, you know, throwing his head, and that's generally what we see. But when you're getting the unlucky ones going against you as well. So, yeah, they're going to have to find something, the Dogs. And I think we're going to talk about them a little bit later.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
We spoke about Max Gawn a fair bit last week. But
do we ever?
He
we never
proved
stopped
to be a little
about
bit of a match winner. On the weekend against Geelong, it one of his efforts that we want to put the spotlight on was that long range 55-metre goal that he kicked in the last quarter. And it's not the first time.
What do you think of that goal?
Great goal. It's not the first time he's kicked one from outside 50. I think it was the 2021 prelim against Geelong. He launched one from about the same range. And earlier this year, I know it doesn't count statistically and officially, but in a practice match against Carlton, yeah, he kicked a really long goal from outside the arc at Icon Park as well. He can tend to get the yips from closer, but he tends to be quite good from outside 50. And
came to my mind now. Put a pin in what we're saying. If Christian Petrarca kicks that goal, is it as good a goal as what Max Gawn did? The exact goal? Because there's so much of this.
In terms of what, though?
In terms of how we view it and how just everything about it. Because there's so much of this feels like the Sam Draper goal of the year from a couple of years ago, where
I agree with you, that was a terrible goal.
But it's the fact that a ruckman does it makes it seem far better than
from
it is.
From outside 50, still.
Okay, he's kicked the goal from outside 50. Yeah, that's great. But it's not like people are making out like no one's ever kicked the goal from outside 50 ever
before.
It's
more because we know how bad a shot he can be.
About 300 or something like that.
Go through those numbers.
But yeah, we did put it to you, Christian, though, and we wanted you to take a look at who are the best shots at goal from outside 50, whether they be
current players
or in the past as well. We know Jake hates Ruckman, but let's park him aside for a second. What do the numbers say?
So we'll start with just current day players and who's kicked the most goal, who's had the most shots from outside 50 and who's kicked the most goals from outside 50. So I'm sure you'll be able to guess the player.
The current player or modern
current
day?
Player.
Current
with
player.
With the most goals kicked from outside 50.
I would have thought Tex.
I would have said Jeremy Cameron, but.
Okay, it's Taylor Walker by a long way. So if you look at shots, he's taken 298 shots from outside 50 across his career. Next most of any current day player is Patrick Dangerfield, 169.
That's right.
So 130 more shots he's taken. He's also, Taylor Walker that is, kicked 118 goals from outside 50. The next most is Dangerfield, who's the only other player over 50 across his career at 55. So Taylor Walker a long way ahead.
And how many shots from outside 50 had Danger had?
169. So Dangerfield's at about a 33% accuracy. Taylor Walker's 40% accuracy.
It's funny, like Gawn, who does get the yips closer in, Dangerfield has in the past as well, but it's funny when the further out you are, the more you can kick through the footy.
I don't know. Is 33% good from outside 50?
It's about just the rest of the top 20 guys for goals from outside 50 are all around 40 to 39% accuracy. Yeah. So
I guess you don't take those shots if you can't. You generally aren't taking those shots if you can't make the distance or you're not confident about it.
Yeah, exactly. And as I said, we will record it if you tried it and fall 10 metres short, but you're not seeing many players do that anymore. So, as I said, Dangerfield second with 55. Tom Hawkins, Gunston and Joe Danaher all equal third at 48.
Yeah, Danaher, I'm surprised he's not actually higher.
My mind did go straight to the left footers when I did think about this. I envisaged a Matt Suckling getting a handball receive and launching him from outside 50 as well. I just get a feeling launch it. I don't know.
Are you left or right?
I'm a righty.
Okay, yeah. So you just always, you grew up wishing you had a left foot?
I just imagine left footers are just longer kicks. I don't know. It's a weird thing with me, but I just think they are.
So we've been looking at distance from shots from 1999 onwards. And Taylor Walker has taken the second most shots of anybody from outside 50 in everything we've recorded, those 298 I was saying. So the most shots outside 50, again, you look at how far Taylor Walker is ahead of every other current day player. It's a safer Buddy Franklin when you're comparing him to the rest of the competition. So 439 shots from outside 50 in that time, 298, as I said, the next most, for 196 goals, so 45% accuracy in that time. If you look at sort of the top 20 players for goals kicked from outside 50, so I said Franklin number one at 196, Taylor Walker, Pavlich was actually second at 127 for goals kicked from outside 50. Favola 121, and then Taylor Walker's fourth at 118. Favola's probably got the best accuracy though. So Favola of the top 20, only Savrocker. So Savrocker kicked 61 goals from his 110 shots from 99 onwards. So we don't have all of Savrocker's whole career. That's just from 99.
What was Fev, sorry?
So Savrocker 55% from outside 50. Fev was 53%, 121 goals from 228 shots. So they're the most accurate in terms of players that have taken a lot of shots.
Because you've got it to kick it from the outside 50. You've got to kick it nearly 60 to clear the goal line and
make exactly. sure it's not touched. Yeah, you've got the accuracy to contend with plus the distance of being touched or spoiled on the line and not making the distance. So the most accurate players sort of kept it to minimum of about 20 shots, I think. So this is full career. It's quite interesting. When you look at the most accurate outside 50 players, I've got 25 names here. And only one is a modern day player. So Harry Himmelberg at the moment has kicked 12 goals from 21 shots outside 50. He gives him a 58% accuracy.
The first name that came to my head was Jaden Short. He was someone that I thought would be on this. So
yeah, so this is just straight accuracy. I mean, Brett Burton, going back, he scored 20 goals from 30 shots for 67% accuracy from outside 50. So a bit of a surprising name. Matthew Bate from Melbourne, who I remember we used to write the AFL prospectus every year, and he always come up high. He just kicked the ball long. He got the ball and just kicked it 50 metres, so you can see from outside.
That's a fan sort of player, isn't it? Kick it long.
Yeah. So sort of talk about most accurate. So 20 most accurate players, only one is a modern day player. If you look at the least accurate players, all except four modern day players. So you got Clayton Oliver, who's had 22 shots from outside 50 across his career. For two goals.
And I believe, wasn't one of them in the grand final? When they went on that run? And I was
2021, yeah.
I'm pretty sure he got one inside.
Yeah.
Okay.
Next worst, Ollie Wines, 20 shots for two goals. Jeremy Finlayson, 31 shots for four goals. And we know Finlayson is one of the, is a really inside, accurate kick. Jack Silvani, 3 from 24. Hugo Hagen, 3 from 23. Norton, 3 from 21. So, as I said, that's all those names I've given are obviously all current day players. That is looking at every single player from 1999 onwards. So, I think whether we're seeing more license for some of these midfielders to have a, as we were sort of saying back in the early 2000s, it was only allowed for certain players. Now it seems like, you know, Clayton Oliver's got license to, he doesn't nail him hardly ever, but you wouldn't think Simon Goodwin's going to pull him up if he does sort of burst out of a stoppage and have a ping from outside 50. It's probably part of what he's doing. So, but yeah, I think it's safe to say that goal kicking from outside 50 has probably dropped from where it was.
Why do you think that? Do you reckon it is the license?
I always look at a lot of things to do with accuracy and just think more players are just getting involved.
Are they more unselfish if they've got the ball outside and they look for the pass inside?
Again, I think it was just in the early 2000s, only forwards kicked goals. Most of the goals were kicked by guys that trained in that position and were paid for that single thing. I know forwards are getting less accurate now because they're probably incorporating more into their training methods. But a lot of the things I look at, I think it's just more backmen, more midfielders, more ruckmen taking shots than ever before brings accuracy and things like this down.
Yeah. We've already said there were some big results on the weekend. Christian, you've taken a bit of a deeper look at the games, and it's fair to say a few things have come out of the round that easily caught your eye. So where do you want to start?
Let's go back all the way to the second game of the round, Carlton Collingwood.
We should actually.
And you would have heard it on the commentary as well if you're listening to the commentators on Channel 7. I noticed it as well, but they were big on Carlton just couldn't get any forward movement from the handball. A lot of their stoppage movement from the stoppages was backwards handballs to a guy in space, and then they tried to kick it. Because they were getting 20 metres away from the stoppage, their 40-metre kick was getting him 20 metres gain from the actual stoppage, whereas it just looked like Collingwood, once they won the ball, they were able to break forward more. So I just looked at handball metres gain differential. So Carlton had 70-odd metres gain from handball, and Collingwood was over 500. So it was 429 more metres gained by handball by Collingwood versus Carlton on the night. Fourth highest differential in a game this season. The three highest differentials have all been GWS games. So it's a very... Hardwick, brought it along. Kingsley has taken it to another level at GWS. It is just what they do. But it's the second time. So Collingwood, round 20 last year, Carlton did get the chocolates in that game, but Collingwood had 500 more metres gained from handball in that game as well. Clear structure thing for Collingwood. I think they know that Carlton are a very handball-happy team, very good at contest and want to keep the ball in tight. Yep. Force them backwards, because they're not going to break out into open space. And then once Collingwood won the ball, it was, well, no point trying to go backwards and keep it in the contest. Let's just break it out into space. So, putting the supporter hat on, that was the one thing I found, is just every time Carlton won possession of the ball, we'd have to lose 10 metres before we could actually get any sort of clean disposal. Collingwood.
I don't think it's anything that, I'm not going to say something that no one's noticed, but I think it's quite clear that Carlton look far more dangerous when the umpire has the ball and it becomes a contest.
Yeah.
Once the ball, and we saw it against Geelong as well, not the exact same style of play to beat them, but once the ball got to the outside, the opposition looks far more comfortable knowing what to do.
They thrive off the stopping stuff.
There's a little bit of, we saw it probably about this time last year, where is that almost hesitancy or uncertainty as to what to do with the ball in terms of transition. And I think that's a real concern and something that they need to work. Because it looked like they'd fix that in the back half of last year. And I don't know if that's just a couple of things that have crept in against some good opposition. But yeah, it's certainly something that...
Should Michael Voss double down on, we're the best contest team, let's just do that and... Well, the numbers would sort of suggest that
if you go back to the GWS game, it's probably the best example of it. They couldn't really play it on that term. Very early in that game, they played at very high stoppage base. GWS just took all the stoppages out. Once GWS won possession, especially the second quarter, short, sharp kicks all the way through, just refused to kick to contest. Carlton couldn't get the game back on their terms. Third or fourth quarter, it just returned to contest and it was clearances and it was the way Carlton sort of set up. So again, it's always hard to sort of watch a game and go, was that GWS's fault or Carlton's fault? But you clearly see the two styles of games and how Carlton would fare. In the second quarter, when it was an open game style, Carlton were never in the contest.
Yeah.
Once it became more stoppages and contest
based. Not to make this a Carlton-centric, take away from everything that you're going to talk about now, but is the lack of pace and speed, particularly in the midfield, a major concern and something that can hold Carlton back from going all the way, which is something that wasn't crazy to suggest.
Yeah, simple answer, yes. It's the one deficiency that they have.
I think it's a
Adam
huge issue.
Adam Saad coming back probably helps with that, the drive off halfback.
Yeah. But I still think it's the biggest weakness in the team right now. And we've seen it in a couple, as I said, we've seen it in a couple of weeks against different types of teams with the way they want to play. And I think on each occasion, it's that lack of pace that causes issue. And there's no, the opposition is allowed to transition the ball far too easily.
Positive for Carlton is they were close games anyway.
They have been close games, but I think we'll move on because we can keep talking about this for a long time. The fact that our forwards can't take a mark in space, it's just... everything's contest, contest, contest. Mm-hmm. I don't know how sustainable that is.
So talking about that, it's probably a good segue into the next one. So that was Friday night, wasn't it? So 2 days later, Richmond Freo at the MCG played one of the most uncontested games I've ever seen. And it was only, 209 contested possessions were won between the two teams for the whole game. Second fewest in any game since 2010, which is excluding the whole 2020 season, which was shortened. It was from the 1 minute mark that I worked on that game. Basically, as soon as they got it out of stoppage, you could tell neither team wanted to kick it back to a contest. They were both happy to go sideways, backwards. Mm. Freo got some score early on the scoreboard. And then again, in the second quarter, both teams just stopped. And no one was concerned with scoring going forward. It was just Freo were the most uncontested possession team going around. So it's clearly a Freo style that they like. But I think Richmond also realised sort of where they're at and where Fremantle plays. Sort of like, there's no need to be going cracking hard at contests and stoppages. They're not great at it from Richmond's point of view. So I think they were happy to sort of just...
So is Richmond starting to play a bit more like that?
And that's how they did very, very well against Sydney. They were able to just pick apart and find uncontested possessions all the way through. So they've had good periods where I think they are sort of trying to get their ball movement game up. But it was just felt like a game where nearly all 44 players took the day off in terms of, all right, the first 10 minutes, we saw how the game was going to pan out. It's going to be very... open and sideways and just sort of shifting the ball from side to side, and it continued for four quarters.
Just on that game against Sydney, are we going to look back on that in a few months?
The weirdest result.
It's going to be like that when West Coast beat Collingwood over here.
2022.
I think it's just going to be a game like that. How did that happen?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, a little bit like that. And we spoke about it. I think your 6 point going into the round was how bad Richmond were, and they were 17th and 18th and everything.
And of course they won.
For that round, they were 1-2 in all of those stats. So it was almost out of the box in terms of everything they couldn't do for the first three or four weeks they
but
did against Sydney.
It's been back to how it was. So,
Dane Zorko, Sunday night, game 258.
Best individual performance of the year?
It'd have to be up there. So, and just talking about him, he's had 40 disposals, so... previous high was 38. He had 35 kicks.
Jesus.
9 more than he's ever had in the other game.
Doesn't
16
love a
marks.
Ball,
yeah, he got the ball moving quite out into space quite quickly.
Doesn't muck around with that stuff.
32 uncontested possessions, which is 6 more than he's had in any other game, and 853 metres gained, which was also his career high. So, yeah, some of the 4 or 5 main stats that you sort of is usually high up in every game, he's actually had career best in his 258th. But he had 16 kicks in the second quarter alone as well, which is the most kicks in a quarter on record. So, again, that's since 1999.
In any quarter?
In any quarter recorded by Champion Data. So there's a few. He's 35 kicks. I think they were, again, on the broadcast, they were pumping up that 36 kicks is the most we've had since kicks were recorded in 99. There is some games from the 70s and 80s with guys with more kicks that, you know,
you don't,
that are in the AFL database. So whether they exist, the Paul Salmon one's a bit different. That's not in the actual AFL database because it's clearances. But nah, for kicks and handballs, we know that they were being recorded through the 60s and 70s. So the 16 kicks in the second quarter is, most since 99.
That's a ridiculous number, isn't it?
Just looking at a couple other things that said, 258th game to get all of these. He became the oldest player to have 40 disposals in a game since Craig Bradley did so in 2000. And it's also his move behind the ball. So looking at, for all the players that have had at least 10 kicks out of the defensive 50 and 10 kicks into the forward 50, who's got the biggest discrepancy between how well they hit the target based on expected hit rate? So Dane Zorko, when he's kicking out of the back 50, he's plus 10.3%, which almost rates him in the top five best kicks coming out of the defensive 50. When he's kicking into the forward 50, negative 23%. So clearly one of the best kicks in the team, but even for him and looking at his numbers, all of his value is coming from that setup kick
That's
from the back line. Not the old, and
almost
he used to be,
not...
you know, almost we talk about the money kick going inside 50. That used to be one of Dane Zorko's strengths 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
It's good. It's just one of those ones where Brisbane realised a weakness in their game once Kitty Coleman went down. McKenna was out with a hamstring as well. They needed ball movement behind the play. But they also, you know, can only assume that maybe they looked at Zorko and said, hey, you're actually not hitting many targets ahead of the ball. Let's get you down back, see if that can improve. And it has. So he's been one of the best, as I said, kickers coming out of the back 50.
If the season ends all right this moment, is he all Australian?
I think he would be.
I'm trying to think of other half backs who would be in the mix, but he'd have to be in the conversation, wouldn't he? He's had an awesome season, and Kitty Coleman going down opened up that spot for him, but it's worked in their favour, really.
No, absolutely. No, he's been really good.
Just to pump up Hawthorn, so spoke about it after the Sydney game. They smashed Sydney in ground ball in the midfield, got completely pantsed on the scoreboard, but I looked at the stats and said, well, Hawthorn, they had a domination of ground ball in the midfield, plus 30 odd against one of the genuinely good best teams in the competition. It was just really impressive to me. They did it again this week. It's the third time that they've won the ground ball gets by at least 15 in a game this year. So I looked at this stage of the year, teams with better ground ball get differentials at this stage of the year. So if you look at the all ground ball gets, the only teams that have had better at this stage of the year were Bulldogs in 2016, who were premiers. Geelong 2020, runner-up. Bulldogs 2021, runner-up. Port Adelaide 2014 lost the prelim by 3 points.
Heartbreaker.
Yeah. Brisbane 2021, they finished fourth, went out in straight sets, but were clearly one of the better teams. GWS in 2018 made the semis, and Geelong 2021 finished third and made it through to the prelim. So they're the only seven teams that have had a better ground ball get differential across 8 rounds than Hawthorn. If you take out the pre-clearance stuff where Hawthorn aren't as strong at, they're not great at the clearances and winning the ground ball there, it's all post-clearance. So they're plus 93 for ground ball gets post-clearance. Second best differential of any team at this stage since 2014. And again, the teams with better ones, you've got to go back to Essendon in 2000, who were premiers, probably one of the best teams in the last 25 years. Geelong, 2009, again, if not the best team, maybe the second best team of the past 25 years. Collingwood, 2011 as runner-up. West Coast 2003, who did make finals and had a midfield of Kerr, Cousins, Judd, Fletcher, who were just getting into their prime, and Geelong 2020, who were runner-ups. Hawthorn's ground ball get differential sits amongst those clubs right there.
So they're making a prelim.
Well, what I'm saying is, again, clearly we know where they're at, and it is it's sort of a one out of the box stat, but we always talk about when a team's down the bottom of the ladder and in the rebuilding stage and such, you need to have a signature that starts to bleed through and come through.
So that's
one of the best ball movement teams going around last year. So ball in hand, they were really, really great last year. This year, the next step is we're not going to be the greatest at winning contested possessions in the coalface and winning clearances and scoring from those, but let's just spread and just keep winning ground balls and contest outside of the clearance area, which... again, a lot of that just comes down to fitness, hard running, and being in the right place at the right time.
And that's the Sam Mitchell stamp or signature that he's sort of come in and...
Yeah,
and
you can see it very much as Sam Mitchell was very, very good with ball in hand, which was season one. And the next thing he was best at was, again, he was probably better at the clearance stuff. Yeah. But he would know how to teach a good ground ball get, you would have thought.
So something like this, does it, if you're a Hawthorn fan, does that give you confidence, not necessarily for like this year, I don't think we're saying they're going to go and make a prelim this year, but for the next 3 years?
Again,
or is it just one thing that you can kind of say that's an anomaly?
It gives me confidence of 2 or 3 years, and I'm always a long-term sort of person. So you can see the result in itself. As I said, 2 weeks ago against Sydney, they win this stat by plus 30, one of the best performances of anyone for the year, but they lose by 60 points. So fair enough for people to come back and say, how much does it really mean? But as I said, for Hawthorn, it's week 8 of them doing this, and they're one of the best teams at it. If they can continue on in 2.5 years' time, they've got their ball movement down pat, they're one of the best ground ball teams, and they've got, you know, more experience forward. Another thing I looked at Hawthorn numbers-wise, who they've used at full forward this year, they've gone from Mitch Lewis to Luke Bruce to Jack Gunston to Marby Orchol, back to Jack Gunston, played Sicily, to, you know, this is coming from Sicily in the last quarter. Blake Hardwick was their leading goal kicker. They just haven't had any continuity with personnel ahead of the ball.
Depleted with injury as well.
But again, it's one of those stats. You're not only doing it well, you're up there with some of the greatest teams going back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A couple of other little ones. So Brisbane got all the injuries. The way they were sort of able to protect themselves is they just turned it into a kick mark game. So they had a kick to handball ratio of 3.06 across the game. Comp average is about 1.8. So for 1.8 kicks for every handball is what we usually see. They were having 3 kicks for every handball. Went up to 4.02. So this is post clearance again, 4.82 in the final quarter. So once it got away from stoppages, it was 4 kicks for every handball. So again, yeah, it sort of blew the kick and handball ratio for a game out the water this year as the highest game. Probably just the final one. I mentioned Sam Taylor last week. We were talking about our top 5 players and sort of I used the numbers and it was all inside midfielders. And I sort of championed Sam Taylor and Harris Andrews as being 2 guys that I would put in my top 5. They're just so safe down the back. We do look at defensive rating. So what do you keep your opponent to compared to their usual average? The best player for tag rating so far this year is Sam Taylor's teammate, Jack Buckley. So he's clearly beaten Jack Darling, Max King, Charlie Curnow, Joe Danaher, and Logan McDonald this year. He's kept them all basically 59% below their usual output, which is the number one defensive rating. So I think he's been underrated for a few years, Buckley, but yeah, having another underrated season this year. And one more I'll throw at you, just I've found out across. Who's uses their opposite foot the most?
Well, I've just seen the answer to this.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have guessed who it is, so I'll let you say. But I would have probably gone with... I know we used to talk about Steele Sidebottom, but he doesn't get the ball enough.
So Sidebottom stopped doing it. He's always been up there. So it was Sam Mitchell, who we just spoke about, Robert Murphy.
Didn't Sam Mitchell finish his career with like the same amount of kicks on each foot or something like that?
Yes.
Almost to the kick?
I think he was almost the same amount on each foot. Robert Murphy, who I think retired the same year, finished with the exact same kick rating on either foot. So he was plus 5% with his right foot and he was plus 5% on his left foot. So I remember they both retired and both had sort of symmetrical stats. But it's Mark Blixarves this year. 44% of his kicks are on his right. So we've got him as a left footer because that's what he uses the most. Yeah, very, very, very surprising. I think we know how versatile he is position-wise where he plays. He's actually versatile in how he uses it.
So the foot that you have them... Because obviously they don't come to you and say, well, I'm a right-footed player.
Correct. We start with them in June. So we start at the champs. Just if you have one kick at the champs and it's on your left foot,
you're a
left foot until we know more. And then it comes in. So it's from champs into AFL career, really, that we keep going. And you're right. So Sam Mitchell, there was 1 year where his dominant foot changed.
So is that going
right one year and it's left the next because it is. It's just based on...
Does that change year on year? Or is it just when you entered the AFL, you were a left footer prominently, so we're going to see you as a left footer? Do you assess that after every season?
Yeah, every season. Rolling. So as soon as...
As soon as you're using one foot,
if you have 10 kicks on your left foot across your first 10 games and then in your 11th game, you have 11 on your right foot, and that's all you have, you'll be a right footer.
So last week, I could be a left footer, but this week I'm going to decide to be a right footer.
So then that's why we don't call it. We say, what's your dominant foot or main foot. What's your main foot and what's your other foot? So we don't tell you, we're not saying Mark Blixarz is a left footer or a right footer. We're just saying his most used foot this year is his left foot. And 44% have been on his right, which is the highest percentage of anybody.
Right. Very interesting. Moving on, we are almost done. But before we do finish up, it's time for justified hype or hyperbole. You know how it works, Jake. I'll give you a statement. You tell me if I'm talking in hyperbole or the hype is justified. And the first one, Luke Beveridge will be coaching the Bulldogs in the last round of 2024.
That's a tough one. Might have to fence it a little bit here, which I always
tend to do that,
criticize.
Don't you?
I'd never do that. I reckon it's a coin flip. I think it's on the board. He's not coaching in round 24. They're 3-5, the Bulldogs, right now. They're struggling. They've just had their worst loss of the season. As I said, they're going to be without Tom Liberatore this weekend, which is, after Marcus Bontempelli, I'd say their most valuable player. So it's not crazy to say that they are reeling. They're in free fall. They should beat Richmond this week regardless though. So they'll be 4-5, I would think. But then, I don't know if you've looked at the fixture after that game. It is a gauntlet. So they play the Giants, Swans, Magpies, Lions and Dockers into the bye. Those five games, and then they have the bye. How many do you think they win of that? Like, from what we've seen, not potential, not what they could do, not, oh, they've got so much talent. Mm. Based on what we know of this year, based on everything from last year, what do we think, how many games in that stretch of five, because I'll give them the Richmond one, even though there's no guarantees, in that stretch of five, GWS, Sydney, Collingwood, Brisbane, Frio, how many are you going to give them? Because I'm only going to give them one. I don't know which one.
Maybe one guarantee, but there's a couple of maybe...
I don't think they're going to start favourite in any of those games.
It's not about starting favourite. It's about winning.
Obviously, but who are they beating? I can't... I would be surprised if they won two or more of those five. So let's...
It'll set up their
season. So let's say they are 1-4. Give them the Richmond win as well as that. They're 5-9 at the bye. Now, that's catastrophic for a team that had... not just top eight hopes, but really top four as well. So if that's the case, I can see a world where they part with Luke Beveridge. I certainly can. Look at the criticism now. Imagine if they lose, they go into the bye at 5-9, which is not beyond the realms of possibility. There's easily a way in which they part with him.
Yeah.
And the thing is, because it happens here, I think they'd want to make that decision sooner rather than later if they were going down that path. If this stretch of five games closed the year, I think he's probably safe, because even if they finish on a five-game losing streak, they make the decision in the off-season, do whatever they do. But because it's now, I think the season could get to the point, either at the bye or not far after it, where it is over for the Bulldogs and they need to make a decision about the future. And I think it's very likely, I think it's 100% on the board that he's not coaching in round 24. I don't think that's crazy.
Interesting to watch whether they are mathematically out of finals calculations.
They won't be out because they're still, you're still going to have...
Is that the moment there they would get rid of him? Is it still mathematically a chance? I think they've got to stick the course.
I think it depends on so many factors. I think it depends on how they're playing. I think you can get a good sense of the playing group and whether they are still playing for him or not. If they're at 5-9, they could be 5-9 and have lost four tight games. Or they could be 5-9 and getting belted and looking like the players have given up. So it is very hard to say. But I think there's definitely a world where they are 5-9 or around that mark. They're looking pretty ordinary. There's no signs that they can bounce back, and they do make that call. He's been there a long time, so
fair enough.
We'll have to wait and see. One for you. Matt Owies should be fined for intentionally diving into the ground to earn a dangerous tackle free kick.
Yeah, just a five. I think he should have. I reckon that's a really shocking look for the game to exploit that rule and con the umpire into giving him a free kick for... cracking down on dangerous tackles like we are, with concussions being one of the most serious issues in the game right now, I just don't think it's a good look to do what he did. Now, this isn't the first time someone has quote-unquote cheated in the game. You think of ducking, and I'm talking about exploiting rules. When you throw yourself forward from a marking contest to act like you're pushed in the back, those sort of things we know have happened for a very long time and probably will continue to happen. Jake Lever made the most of it a couple of weeks ago with the tackle from Charlie Cameron. The difference is that was a dangerous tackle, but this tackle just had everything to do with Matt Owies and nothing to do with Braden Maynard. I just reckon it's a really... I mean, I was shocked that someone would intentionally risk a really bad injury to your neck or your head just to get a free kick. I don't like the look of it. Braden Maynard's not a light man. It could have been a lot worse, and it just takes one kid at the junior level to copy what he did, throw himself forward, risk snapping his neck because he thinks he's going to get a free kick for it. A tragedy can happen on the field by doing this. I think it's a really stupid,
couple
stupid
of things.
Thing.
He's not the only one I've seen do it, so I would be hoping that the AFL might be sending a few quiet letters out to players. So they're saying, we noticed you did this.
You've got to find them.
There was a Gold Coast.
Well, why find them? Why not suspend them?
Or do that. They have to be sanctioned somehow. Otherwise, it's going to...
I think it's too drastic from where we are. We don't see enough fines or punishments for staging. So that's why I think with this one here, AFL, get on the front foot, and that's what I'm saying. Send a private letter or an email to that player saying, we saw you do this, stop doing it. I don't think we're at the stage we need to be fining players at this stage, just because I've seen more worse dives that we're clearly glossing over and not getting. We have this whole ability to fine players for diving, but we just don't see it enough. But for this one, I think it's got to be put on the agenda first. The AFL needs to tell the players, hey, we're noticing you're doing this. We don't like it. Give them a warning. Say next year that's going to be a fine or a suspension, whatever it is, but give them a year.
It should
to sort
be,
of
eventually.
Do
yeah,
it. And the other part to that one, I found it really frustrating again. Supporter hat completely off. There was times where Collingwood was tackling Carlton blokes and they were throwing the ball. Carlton will tackle Collingwood, they throw the ball and drop the ball. And I was just watching with my, 7-year-old son, just saying, tackling is not being rewarded at all. What is the point of tackling a bloke? And then this one was paid a free kick against Maynard, and that was the only time I had, tongue in cheek, said, I'm done with footy. The rest of the tackles were not getting rewarded. That was the one good tackle of the game where it locked the ball in, and it was a free
tackle
against.
If Matt Owies snapped his neck, what would we be saying about Braden Maynard right now? Honestly.
Exactly.
It was stupidly dangerous.
I agree.
Stupidly 100%. Dangerous.
Now, I don't think we see, like you said, I don't think it's a real issue in the game in the sense that we see it far too often, multiple times a game. I don't think it is at that level.
This was sort of just the worst one with the way that it was, with Maynard falling on top of him and always throwing himself down the way he did. A tragedy really could have happened. I don't think people understand that when you look at it. Accidents happen on a footy field. Christian, last one is for you. Jake Soligo is the most improved player in the AFL. Showdown medalist.
Yeah, he's very, very good. But unfortunately, I've got to go to the numbers to sort of back me up on this one. So for the first three games, he probably didn't do anything, being really, really good for the last 5 weeks.
Soligo, is this?
This is Josh Soligo, yeah. So if you look at his form in the last 5 weeks compared to his form last year, look at all players' form in the last 5 weeks compared to last year, he's the 21st, most improved in the last 5 weeks. If you look at the whole season, he's sort of 90th, as I said, because of his first three games where he sort of didn't have much impact. But if we talk about the players that are most improved, it goes back to the guy we'll talk about at the top of the podcast. And you said people are underestimating just how good his season is. Isaac Heaney has improved the most compared to where his old output versus his new output is the number one.
Talent-wise, he was, but then output and not playing in the midfield so much is obviously... held back what his potential obviously was.
Yeah, exactly.
And how many Isaac Heaneys are there? How many Isaac Heaneys are playing
now? That's what I was going to look at. So he's number one for ball winning, rating points from his ball winning, and fifth from his rating points from ball use. Usually you're not in the top 20 of both of those. You're either really, really good at ball winning and give off little handballs and don't get as much from your ball, or you're really good at ball use. You're an outside player. Nick Martin gets, 1,000 metres gain and things like that. Heaney's doing both. He'll go in and win it first, but then if you give Heaney a handball, he's also going to get you 50, 60 metres and hit a target further up the field.
He's extraordinary.
So, he's been the most improved player, whether he's been a star previously or not. Brandon Parfitt, second. He's had another sort of underrated year for... I talk about Geelong a lot in terms of their midfield. He's just a completely different midfield to what they won the premiership with. Brandon Parfitt's been a big part of, revitalising that midfield. Tom Power for North's been up there. One of the guys I looked at as well is Matt Rowe. So if you look at where you are in, so we spoke about 100X players and, you're standing across 100X, which is looking at how often you play in a certain position and sort of extrapolating that out to 100 minutes and what you would average. When Rowe came into the competition, we know about his first three games, he polled Brownlow votes in all of them and he was
think it
pretty
was
pretty good to watch.
Game 2-3-4, he pulled 3-3-3 or something like that.
And he was really good to watch. He was 172nd rated in the 100X ratings at the end of his debut year. 72nd last year, 5th this year. So that's one of the biggest jumps of anyone. And Saligo's teammate's probably been the second biggest jump of anyone. So Isaac Rankin has gone from 199th to 63rd to 57th. He's now a top. He's now 9th in their 100X ratings.
You're pretty big on him at the start of the year.
Who's that?
Isaac Rankin. Thanks for listening. Yeah. No, he's been very good. But no, just going back to Heaney quickly, my point about how many Heaneys are there. How many players are there that aren't played in the midfield right now that, I'm not saying could go and do what he's doing, but would take a drastic step if they were to be put in the midfield. Like, I reckon, not to say every club would have one, but I reckon there's a few players like that where they need that opportunity and it might all just, it could just click.
Yeah.
And they take their game to not just the next level, but they skip a couple of levels.
Yeah, it's a little bit different to your Heaney point, but I watch the VFL a lot sometimes, or some guys in the VFL, and they just think, he cannot play VFL. He needs to be in the AFL. There's certain guys that run the right patterns. They get to the right spots. Like, VFL is not rewarding these guys because it's a lot of... It's like, there are certain players that's the other way. It's like, give this guy a game with better players around him and he'll be 10 better. Times better than what he should be at this lower level competition. Yeah. So.
Any room for Hayden Young?
No, he wasn't Brent in. Dennis. So, yeah, no. Frio's most improved. Caleb Sarong's the name I sort of got there outside the top 100 2 years ago
as well,
to 10th.
But yeah, his season last year.
Hayden Young didn't come up in the sort of 15 names I've sort of got in front of me.
Black. My boy.
Have you got my $5 ready?
Not yet. It's still 20 weeks away from that. That's all we have time for today, guys. Christian, thank you. As always, Jake, I'll see you on Thursday for Red Time.
Yeah, and thanks for stepping in. I think Matt will be
back. He'll be back
next
Tuesday. Yeah, thanks for having me. Who's your favourite host?
Split down the middle, 50-50.
Like picking a favourite son. Thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll speak to you on the next episode.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.